Suppression and censorship only fueled the flames. If the Angola angle began to look dubious, Ali was setting the conditions for another equally compelling narrative. A U.S. citizen had conducted the plan, using university assets to build a virology lab and unleash a devil upon the populace. Whichever way one leaned, the end result remained the same. The United States would continue to turn against itself, and by the time they found out the virus was not actually a respiratory spread contagion, it would be too late. Two American cities would be destroyed, and the country would never recover. Pity that Chicago would be spared, but that could not be helped now. Even the Atlanta numbers didn't support the destruction of that city, but the few cases that had surfaced reinforced the perception that this new Ebola strain spread through the air. Iran would have her revenge, and no one would be the wiser. Ali would avenge the deaths of his father and two brothers, killed by an American war machine that profited from Defa-e Mogadas, the Holy Defense, the Iran-Iraq War. Yes, Islam would be blamed if they connected Sebastian to the plot, but everyone who unleashed the virus would be gone. Investigators would hit a dead end. Two American cities would be smoldering embers without Iran ever firing a shot. The very pinnacle of warfare. He'd tasked Sebastian with destroying the lab, better to keep his own involvement to a minimum. Ali had stayed behind to ensure it was done. He had not expected the virus to take hold of the young PhD student so quickly. No matter. Adapting to a changing environment was paramount. It was also why the warriors of Allah had an advantage over the entrenched bureaucracy of their enemy. The house was so old, even the floorboards had rotted through in places. It was a prime candidate for an inferno. With so many assets allocated to investigating the fires and destruction connected to the riots and looting in downtown Denver, this incident could easily be explained away as having been started by someone building firebombs to target police. Molotov cocktails and fireworks had become popular with American insurgents in the summer of 2020. Ali even had an Antifa flag to leave behind for an arson investigator to discover in the rubble. The point was to muddy the waters with further conjecture and confusion. He just needed to dismantle the computer in case Sebastian had been careless and left electronic evidence that could possibly implicate Ali or Iran. A fire would not destroy everything that was part of the plan. There needed to be just enough evidence left behind to feed the conspiracies dominating social channels. He'd suit up, take what he needed from the basement, set the fire, and be out of the state before anyone connected the fire to the outbreak, if they ever did. The world gave the Americans too much credit. They had grown stupid and weak. A generation of fast food and instant gratification had left them soulless. He thought of all he had accomplished. He remembered the wailing of the women, the rotting meat permeating his olfactory nerves, his brother hanging by his neck, legs stained with piss and shit. He briefly thought of traveling south to kill the former Secretary of Defense in New Mexico, the man who had prolonged and armed both sides in the Holy Defense, the Iran-Iraq War, the man responsible for the death of his father and two brothers. He pushed that notion aside. Rumsfeld would be dead soon. He was an old man now. Ali wanted him to see his country burning before he descended into the fires of hell. Ali stifled a cough. Was he coming down with something? There is no way he could have contracted the virus, was there? He'd taken precautions, unlike that idiot Ustinov. All he needed to do was dismantle the computer, start a fire, and drive east for his flight back to Europe to watch America destroy itself on Al Jazeera. Ali grabbed a screwdriver from a drawer in the kitchen and was halfway down the stairs when he heard the knock on the door. Chapter 49, Interstate 70, Denver, Colorado.
"What did you find out, Reese?"
Vic asked over the encrypted connection. The Suburban sped down the deserted highway toward Denver, K Ken was behind the wheel and Haley was in the back seat, quiet, and still fuming at Reese's behavior with Sharam. "This virus is not, I say again, not from Angola. Sharam built a virology lab in that house he bought in Denver. The man I photographed leaving my first target house in Chicago was his contact."
"Do you have a name?"
"No, but we are going to the Denver house now. Is SWAT or HRT on scene?"
"Reese, this is an unprecedented situation. SWAT and HRT have their hands full. The country is descending into chaos. Politicians are at each other's throats. Coordinating with local authorities and even federal offices is bottlenecked. Request for SWAT was approved, but they are not yet on site. There should be a black and white on scene now, but I have not received confirmation."
"Shit. Understood."
"Did he verify the type of virus? Is it airborne?"
"It's something called Marburg Variant U. Haley says it was originally from Africa and weaponized by the Soviet Union in the 70s. They were working on an aerosol delivery system." The Suburban's brakes locked up and Reese was thrown forward in his restraint.
"What the fuck? What are you doing?"
the commando shouted at their driver.
"Protesters, sir. They've shut down the highway."
"Damn it, keep going. Just keep it slow and try not to kill anyone."
"I'm not trained for this, sir."
"Keep the doors locked and slowly edge through them."
"What's going on, Reese?"
Vic asked.
"Crowd of protesters blocking the highway."
"Jesus Christ."
"Vic, you have got to tell the president this is not a naturally occurring virus. We are going to upend the Denver house and find a connection to the man in Chicago. He's the key."
The Suburban slowly approached the protesters. Their voices became louder. Anti-government signs, chants.
Mr. Donovan?
Ken said nervously from the driver's seat.
"Don't stop, just move slowly."
"Vic," Reese said back into the phone. "Tell the president not to order the strikes until we can confirm if this thing is airborne. If it's not, he's going to kill 500,000 people for nothing."
"The president is under serious pressure from both sides of the aisle to stop the spread, to do the unthinkable."
"What? I thought the final option was a closely guarded secret."
"It was, but it leaked. It's not out in the public yet, but enough people are talking about it in Congress that it won't be long."
Sir?
Ken said. The Suburban was completely surrounded. Protesters pounded on the hood and windows as the large black vehicle crept forward.
"I don't like this, sir."
"Neither do I. Just keep going."
Antifa signs repurposed from the events of the past year were held aloft by men and women in black hoodies with masks. One man climbed up over the hood and onto the top of the slow-moving vehicle, slamming his fist onto the roof and screaming obscenities.
"Keep it slow," Reese said. "Just don't stop."
"Surprised you don't just plow through them,"
came Haley's voice from the passenger row.
"I don't want to hurt these people. I understand their position. That being said, I will not let them keep us from our mission."
Reese and Haley were still dressed in the CBRN suits they had changed back into as they reversed the sanitization and sterilization process on their way back through the mobile Level 4 biocontainment module. Their masks were off as soon as they were well out of the containment zone and DMZ.
"What's happening, Reese?"
Vic asked, the strain in his voice obvious.
"Still working our way through these protesters."
"Get to that house. Find me something that confirms this is not airborne. Something concrete. If not, I fear the president will have no choice. If destroying these cities saves the country, possibly the world, he's got no choice."
"Just hold him off. Do not drop. Give me time."
Even at the slow pace, Reese jolted forward in his seat when Ken slammed on the brakes again. Reese looked ahead and saw why they'd stopped. The crowd had parted. Four armed men blocked the path, pointing shotguns and ARs directly at the front window of the Suburban. Chapter 50. Reese didn't hesitate. OODA. Observe, orient, decide, act. Weapons, enemy, threat. Reese picked up his left leg and pushed it over the center console, slamming it onto the gas pedal. At the same time as all 420 horses leapt to life, he grabbed the steering wheel. Their vehicle had become a weapon.
Steel shot from the scattergun impacted the passenger side of the windshield, which spiderwebbed across the screen. Two of the ARs barked, one missing completely, the shots going wildly high over the vehicle and protesters. The man with the second AR found his target just before the large vehicle connected with him and sent him careening to the side. The driver's side of the windshield diverted the trajectory of the bullets, but not enough. Ken's body absorbed a round that drove down into his stomach. A second hit his headrest. A third entered his shoulder and fragmented into the top of his heart. A fourth passed through his throat, spraying blood across the steering wheel, dashboard, and the left side of Reese's face. Haley screamed as the large vehicle thumped over the man with the shotgun, dragging him for a few yards down the road before the right rear tire caught his leg and spit him out. "Get down!" Reese yelled at Haley. He kept his foot on the gas, driving from the passenger seat, putting distance between them and the threat as bullets whizzed overhead and along the pavement beside them. Ken's body slumped forward in his seatbelt, body draining of blood, draining of life. Reese elbowed him back in his seat and kept him pinned in place as he put more distance between them and their attackers, the Suburban speeding up past 100 miles per hour. Reese moved his elbow from Ken's chest and attempted to apply pressure to the throat wound with his left palm while keeping the car on the road, his hands slick with blood. He took his eyes from the highway to assess Ken's wounds. Instead of a young, freshly shaven face with an unruly mop of blonde hair, he saw a young bearded SEAL in body armor and helmet behind the wheel of a Hilux truck on a dusty road on the outskirts of a village in Afghanistan. Reese holding the wheel while attempting to stem the flow of blood spurting from his teammate's neck, just before another AK round tore his head off.
"Reese! Reese!"
Haley's screams brought him back to reality, and he swerved to keep the Suburban on the road.
"Stop the car, Reese! Stop the car!"
she shouted. Reese looked in the still-intact rearview mirror and confirmed they were off the X and about 2 miles down the road from the ambush. He pulled to the side of the empty freeway and turned his attention to Ken, holding pressure on his throat and sliding a finger through the blood to plug the hole.
"This thing should have a trauma kit," Reese yelled to Haley. "In the back, find it."
Haley threw open her door and ran to the back of the Suburban.
"It's locked. Hit the unlock button."
"Shit."
Reese moved farther across his seat, pushing a finger from his left hand into the hole in Ken's neck, his right hand slippery with blood, searching desperately for the button on the driver's side door to release the back lift gate.
"Got it."
Reese heard a beep as the rear lift gate arched skyward, Haley reaching underneath to accelerate its power-assisted movement. She appeared at the driver's side door and Reese grabbed the handle to open it.
"I've got him,"
Haley said, tracing Reese's fingers to the hole in Ken's neck and packing it with gauze from the kit. As Reese felt Haley replace his fingers with gauze, he pushed himself back to the passenger seat and exited the vehicle, his eyes scanning in all directions for threats as he rushed to Haley's side and helped ease Ken to the ground. Haley continued to stuff Ken's neck wound with gauze while Reese took a knee and ran his hands over Ken's body, looking for additional injuries, finding the entry wound in his shoulder and immediately applying pressure.
"Another entry wound, left shoulder," he shouted.
"Reese,"
Haley said calmly.
"Do we have more gauze?"
"Reese,"
she said again. This time Reese picked his head up.
"He's gone, Reese."
Reese looked back to the shoulder wound, then to the throat, and then into the eyes. Ken's face was ashen. There was no rise or fall of the chest, no beating of the heart. Reese looked at his hands, then to Haley. The left side of his face was covered with what was now drying blood. Ken's blood. He saw a young SEAL lying in the red Afghan dirt. The left side of his head was missing.
"Reese, he's gone,"
Haley said again, the compassion in her voice directed at the former SEAL commander. Reese shook the Afghan memory from his mind. Without another word, he stood, hoisting the young CIA analyst to his shoulder and laid him in the back of the Suburban. "Load up. We have work to do." Chapter 51. West Colfax, Denver, Colorado. Reese pulled the Suburban to the curb a block from the Target house. The street was deserted, though this was not the type of neighborhood whose residents would have second homes in Aspen or Telluride. These families were sequestered to protect themselves and their loved ones from the unseen threat of a virus with an epicenter only miles away.
"Which one is it?"
Haley asked. "That one," Reese said, pointing. "See the beige Crown Vic?"
"Yeah."
"That's an unmarked police car."
"I don't see the cop,"
Haley observed. "Neither do I. One car in the driveway," Reese continued, looking at the dark, late-model Jeep Cherokee backed up to the garage. "Can you tell what state those license plates are from?"
"New York, I think,"
Haley said, squinting through her glasses. "That's what it looks like to me, too. Maybe a rental?" Reese said aloud.
"Could be."
"Haley, I don't know what to say. We would not be here without you." Reese paused. "I need to tell you something that's highly classified. It's probably going to break into the news cycle soon anyway. I just need you to know why we're doing this."
"To find the source of this virus. I know why we are doing it."
"That's part of it. But I'm talking consequences. Haley, if the President and Congress think that a virus with an 85 to 90% mortality rate is airborne, highly contagious, and confined to two U.S. cities, they, or I should say, the Commander-in-Chief, has an option at his disposal to contain the spread."
"Not a vaccine. We talked about that. There isn't one yet, and you don't miraculously create one by finding a monkey or index case like in the movies."
"No, not a vaccine. A more drastic solution."
"I don't understand. There is likely evidence in this house to prove that the virus is aerosolized, that someone has to physically come into contact with the aerosolized virus. Those infected can only spread it the same way Ebola is spread, through direct blood or bodily fluid contact, not via respiratory pathways. Once we have that evidence, I get it to the CDC, and we let the American people know it's not contagious in the way they've been led to believe. We continue to treat the infected, but without the fear that a cough or sneeze will spread it. If we prove it's a bioweapon and that it was aerosolized in an attack on Aurora and Richardson, we can move forward, rationally."
"We're on the clock, Haley, and so is the President. If we can't prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that this is not being spread from person to person, the President is going to incinerate the containment zones to prevent the spread."
"What? Just like I saw in Africa?"
"What choice does he have? It's either two cities or 280 million people in the U.S. alone."
"We wouldn't destroy our own cities, would we?"
Haley said in utter disbelief.
"How do you even do that? Nuke our own country? The radiation would be devastating far beyond the borders of the containment zones."
"Not a nuke. A fuel-air explosive. The largest non-nuclear device in the arsenal."
"How long have you known this?"
"Just before we questioned Shahram." Haley's eyes glistened over, her breathing pronounced, her mind weighing the options and possibilities. "I need to make one more call, and I'm going to show you how to use this thing," Reese said, holding up the Kryptol mobile phone. "Then I'm going in that house. If anyone other than me comes out, tail them and call Vic. Help vector the cavalry in, but stay back. You've gotten us to this point. No one knows more about what's going on and what's at stake than you do." Haley watched in silence as Reese showed her how to use the encrypted phone to dial the CIA. "Vic, run this plate. Echo Bravo Foxtrot 8473.
"Stand by, Reese," Vic said.
Reese could hear him passing the information to an analyst in the background.
"Vic, we lost Ken Daniel. Shot by the protesters. I'm so sorry."
Silence.
"Vic?" "Shit." "Reese, I..."
Vic paused and took a breath.
"SWAT is en route to your location. I'd ask you to stay outside and wait, but I know you won't, so I'll refrain from wasting my breath."
"What's the status on the final option?"
"Just came from the director's office. She bought us until the end of this cycle of darkness, then he's launching. Congress was informed via an emergency session. They are all in mandatory lockdown on Capitol Hill, but the word will get out. They are all thinking about protecting their constituents and what happens if 90% of them die. This is going to leak, Rhys. When it does, there will be mass chaos and the president will have to speed up the timeline. If those trapped in Aurora and Richardson get wind of this, there will be a mass rush on the containment barriers, and the virus will get out. Rhys closed his eyes and whispered a quick prayer. Rhys, are you there?
I'm here.
Rhys heard mumbling on the other end of the phone. Okay, that car is a rental enterprise rented by an Ali Ansari through a corporate account of a company called Biodyne out of Switzerland. Doing a deep dive on Ansari now.
Rhys's mind was spinning.
Rhys?
I'm here, Vic.
I don't need to tell you what happens if Ali is the connection to this virus. If he has the answers that can save Aurora and Richardson.
I know, Vic. We need him alive.
Do what you can, Rhys.
I'll keep the...